Welcome everybody. Thank you very much for coming to our Parliamentary Library lecture today on the very, very important issue of the international economy. We are very fortunate to have Professor Michael Hudson with us today. He is doing a whirlwind tour of Australia with far too many speaking engagements, but we are absolutely thrilled to have you here. Professor Michael Hudson is the Distinguished Research Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. He's a policy insider and government advisor to no less than 9 countries over the last few years. In 2009, in the year of the financial crisis, has seen him on constant call to those countries hit hardest by the GFC, namely Iceland and Latvia. He's recently returned from a successful visit to Latvia, assisted in the rewriting of their economic policy. Earlier this year, he was invited to speak at the United Nations General Assembly's Future of Globalisation Conference. He was listed as one of the 12 economists who predicted the crisis and has had a very, very distinguished history, career, including former balance of payments economist for Chase Bank, Chase Manhattan Bank and Arthur Andersen. In 1990, he established the world's first third world sovereign debt fund at Schroeder, which I've pronounced wrongly, I'm sure, Stevens and Clark, which went on to be the second best performing international fund. I could talk about his career for a very long time, but what I will do is now invite him to speak to us on this very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. I should say that in 1990, when it was the fund I started, was the first third world sovereign debt fund. The one fund in the world to beat me out was an Australian real estate fund. And we all expected then that the real estate bubble was really getting going. I've just come from Latvia and got off the phone earlier today with Iceland. Both these countries were, 2 years ago, were in the position that Australia is now. They were called the Baltic Tigers in Latvia, and essentially, like most post-Soviet economies, they were running a structural trade deficit, importing almost all of their consumer goods and capital goods, and financing this by borrowing in foreign currency to fuel their real estate bubble. So it was the real estate bubble. In foreign exchange, 90% of Latvia's and Iceland's mortgages are in foreign currency that finance their trade deficit. And when the real estate bubble burst, there's no more foreign exchange lending. There's negative equity now. There is nothing at all to support their chronic trade deficit. And they're like magic carpet countries. No visible means of support. This means that they are unable to stabilize their currency relative to the euro. They're unable to join Europe. And Europe's response has been, if you join us, it's told both countries, you have to close down half of your hospitals. You have to fire half of your doctors. You have to close down half of your schools. And 10% of your population must emigrate in the next 2 years. This is crazy. And no country is going to do this willingly. In April of this year, Iceland had elections, and 70% of the electorate wanted to join Europe. And as a result, the Green coalition with the Social Democrats won. Today, after Gordon Brown of England said he was in Parliament, that he was going to use the IMF as a collection agent against money that England lost through English banks that were owned by Icelanders being bailed out against all EU rules. Iceland's support for the European community has fallen by 40%. So European expansion has come to a halt. Hungary is in about the same position as Latvia. It had a foreign exchange trade deficit. It borrowed from the Austrian banks. Almost all of the post-Soviet economies have borrowed from foreign banks and foreign currency because the Soviet Union didn't have any banks. In 1991, They emerged from Russian domination free of debt. There was no debt. There were no property claims. They could have been the most competitive economies in the world. Instead, Latvia imposed a flat tax of 59% on its labor and across the board, no progressive taxation, and a property tax of 0.1% based on the most recent estimates of property, which were made in 1917. So the result, of course, was a property bubble. For 18 years, Latvians, Hungarians, Icelanders thought that the whole economy was getting rich as their real estate prices soared. And all of a sudden, when the bubble burst, they found that what had determined real estate prices were whatever banks would lend. And banks essentially were lending against whatever income the homeowners or the corporate investors could squeeze out of their property, and now they're left with negative equity. In Iceland, property prices have fallen by 75%, and more than half the property is in negative equity. It's almost as bad in Latvia. In the United States, property prices have plunged by about 30% since last year. Every professional property forecaster expects them to fall another 20% or so in the next 2 years, and they say that's as far as the eye can see, so that nobody knows what's happening beyond that. So I think that while Australians are looking at the prospect of houses making them rich, they should realize that a certain point comes in which the economy turns down, and I'm going to explain why it may do that, and leave them with negative equity. And in foreign countries, when they have negative equity, in Latvia, I know one woman, for instance, who had bought an apartment. She lost her job with the IMF closed down the nonprofit sector, and she lost her job with a charity. She can't sell the apartment because its mortgage is 20% over the sales value. If she walks away, she'll be personally liable for life. And when I made the proposal in Latvia 6 weeks ago, that if, in view of the fact that the currency is going to devalue, and people are going to be left with much higher mortgages in their own currency, they changed the law so that people are no longer personally liable for their mortgages. In America, somebody can walk away from their homes, and the bank gets the house, not a further claim on the individual. That's one of the results of the Depression. No such tradition exists anywhere in Europe. And the Europeans, as their property bubble is collapsing, are personally liable. This means that a huge chunk of their income is going to be spent on property, on debts that they've taken on into the past that they cannot follow. Now, the reason I'm bringing this all up, I realize that Australia's debts are not in foreign currency, but there's a belief here that the world economy is recovering. No economist I know in the United States, no fund manager, no money manager, can see a recovery online. What they all see is that the economies have run up so much debt since World War II that more and more of personal income, of corporate income, and of real estate income is pledged to the creditors, leaving much less to be available to be spent on goods and services. So a few weeks ago in New York City, when I walked down Fifth Avenue, the main street, there were many stores that are vacant for rent. Broadway, many stores vacant. A few months ago, I was in London in Oxford Street, their big retail center. Many stores were vacant and for rent, because people are having to cut back their spending, and this is usually the trigger that brings down the property bubble. Now, in Australia, almost everybody I've spoken to in the last week or so has pointed to the rise in the interest rates here is what the government is doing in an attempt to slow the property bubble. I haven't seen any discussion in the press as to what the balance of payments effects of this are and how this is going to affect Australian competitiveness. In any kind of analysis I look at, I'll tell you what's going to happen. When Australia raises the rate to 3.25%, and I'm now told it's probably going to go up to 3.75%, people are arbitrageurs, speculators, are going to borrow at about 1% in New York or in Japan, and they're going to borrow at 1%, invest in 3.25%, and make an arbitrage, the income for themselves. That's free money that they make in their sleep. But when they borrow dollars a yen, they're going to convert this into Australian dollars. This is going to push up the exchange rate, and this is what's pushing up the exchange rate. And I've read in a number of business papers in the last week that Australian manufacturers are now downgrading their profit forecasts because as the dollar goes up, the cost of doing business rises above the cost abroad. There's a common price of world raw materials, a common price of machinery. There are many common prices in the international economy, but what goes up when you revalue a currency is property and taxes, essentially the cost of housing, the cost of real estate, and the cost of paying taxes. And this goes up, revaluing the inflow that pushes up the Australian currency is pricing the manufacturing out of the market. And as I look at the sector output in Australia, the manufacturing output is declining. That means that a lot of people are either losing their jobs or companies simply are not hiring and they're losing labor by attrition. This suggests a shrinking market here. The markets that seem to be going up are the real estate markets, the markets that don't actually produce things, certainly that don't produce exports. What you are producing, of course, is mineral exports. The problem is that as the foreign currency speculators come in to buy Australian bonds, this pushes up the Australian currency, but the price for minerals, steel and iron ore, are set in foreign currency, in dollars or in euros, and that means that in Australian dollars, the profits of the mining companies are going to go down. So it seems to me that if the reason the central bank is actually raising the interest rate to stop the real estate bubble, it's sacrificing manufacturing in the process, it's slowing the economy, it's raising the price that consumers, homeowners, on variable rate mortgages have to pay. So if the rate goes up, they have to pay more on their mortgage, and if they have to pay more on their mortgage, there's less available to spend on goods and services, so markets are going to shrink here. It looks to me like the Australian economy is subjecting itself to debt deflation simply because it's only using financial policy, interest rate policy, to cope with the real estate bubble. In reality, finance and fiscal policy usually go together. And in most economic theory, prior to neoliberalism, fiscal and financial policy went together. If one wanted to stop a real estate bubble, one would simply raise the property taxes in one way or another, or you'd raise a windfall, you impose a windfall tax on property. Instead, to stop the property price inflation in that one sector, you're affecting the whole economy. Now, basically, the property sector is the financial sector. In the United States, in England, 70% of bank loans take the form of mortgage loans. So the largest asset in any economy is real estate. The largest debtor in every economy is real estate. And the largest component of real estate is usually land. It's about half land and half capital improvements in the United States. In Australia, I understand it's much higher, as high as 70 or 75% because it's a low rise of the low-rise building here and the house prices. When the prices of property goes up, that's basically the price of land. And John Stuart Mill said that capital gains of land, the price appreciation, are really land price gains. And economic rent, he said, is an unearned increment that landlords make in their sleep. So basically, Australia has been following a policy really for about 20 years now where the way to get rich is to make money in your sleep, not by capital formation, not by investing in manufacturing. And in fact, by following an economic profile that's remarkably like Latvia and Iceland. And it might be, I would suggest that you follow in the nose the Latvian and Icelandic phenomena, because the structure of what's happening there is very much the same kind of genetic structure of Australia, except they're ahead of the curve. And Australia, thanks to its raw materials exports, largely to Asia, has not had a foreign currency crisis that's led to the downturn in the bubble. But what has made Australia exceptional is simply the fact that it's getting rich by making holes in the ground that other countries aren't able to do. Russia's able to do it, but the other post-Soviet economies are not able to do it, and Iceland is not able to do it. So that causes an inherent problem. Furthermore, I'm looking at the evolution of the tax system, and the tax system has been more and more to enable people to make money and get rich on speculation rather than on capital investment. Cutting the capital gains tax to one half of the rate at which income, profits, and wages are taxed encourages people to get rich by buying assets, by buying real estate, by buying stocks and bonds. And the tax system has more and more encouraged people to ride the wave of asset price inflation. And the problem with this is that it's as the price of housing goes up, it costs homeowners more and more years of their working life to afford excess price to housing, which in effect here means really to the land on which the houses are built. Now, people think that they're getting rich when the price of houses go up, but their getting rich is takes the form of house prices requiring people to pledge more and more of their income for housing, up to about 40% now. 40% of a wage income for housing is pretty much the limit that any country can reach before the prices begin to turn down. That was what pricked the U.S. Housing bubble, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in the United States now is guaranteeing government loans only up to the point where the cost of carrying the housing, the mortgage, is 32% of income. So already they've said 32% is the danger point. We don't want to revive the financial bubble. Australia already is way above that. And by the terms that one would measure other economies, Australia is already in a bubble economy. And what's pushed up this bubble has not been really the rise in the ratio of population to land, as people think. What raises the price of buildings is what people can afford to borrow from a bank. And the more the taxes are cut on property, the more revenue there is to be pledged to the bank. And people have the obvious short-term illusion that if property taxes are imposed, that's going to increase the cost of housing. But actually, that's not what happens at all. When property prices are increased, there's less rental revenue to be capitalized into a bank loan, less revenue to carry a bank loan and to borrow against, and so the banks lend less money. So it's the reverse of lowering the tax. Every time the property taxes in the United States were lowered, that freed more income to be borrowed from the bank, and all that happened is that what used to be paid to the government tax collector is taxes, is now being paid to the banks in the form of interest. Now, at the same time that in 1930, states and municipalities in the United States raised 70% of their local revenue from the property tax. Today, that's fallen to 16%. What have they done? In order to cover the shortfall in property taxes, states and cities have had to impose income taxes, and they've had to pay sales taxes. Now, the problem of this is that taxes on income and sales increase the price of doing business. Real estate taxes lower the price of property, and they not only lower the amount of revenue that's paid out in interest, which is an expense, but they also lower the amount by which the government has to levy taxes on earned income, wages and profits, that raise the the price. So in effect, the shift of taxation off property onto labor and industry has made these economies less competitive. And the limit is reached in the Latvian economy, which, as I said, 59% flat tax on labor, almost no tax on property. Put Latvia at the very head of the World Bank list of business-friendly economies, but the economy's in a collapse. And Iceland is still at the very top of the United Nations list of happiness for living. Suicide rates are rising. Lifespans are shortening. In Latvia, the lifespan since they got independent from Russia for men has shortened by 10 years. From 60 years to 50 years. Disease rates are going up. Cardiovascular disease is going up. The economies are becoming squeezed and much more tense. This is a kind of instability that doesn't appear in the textbooks. I don't know, in the 18th century, there was almost everyone who discussed international trade, David Hume, Adam Smith, the others, they all discussed the effect of foreign trade balances on immigration of skilled labor. That's dropped from the trade theory today. It's all become just a comparative price without looking at the role of trade and of taxation in the international economy. And all the authors of England's Industrial Revolution, the rise to industrial supremacy, all engineered that rise by shifting taxes more and more off labor and industry, more and more onto property. That was what Adam Smith said. Adam Smith supported the American Revolution. He said, let the colonies go free. His contemporary urged that the colonies were a albatross around England's neck. By the time of the Napoleonic Wars ended in 1815, three-quarters of England's budget went to pay bondholders. In other words, three-quarters of the tax revenue was paid that. Book 5 of The Wealth of Nations is all about how each new war led to a new borrowing and a new tax attached to each. Adam Smith said that the natural if England was to compete, it had to stop fighting wars, it had to reduce taxes, and it had to basically tax the landlords, because by taxing the landlords, nature produced the land, and a tax on land would not reduce its supply. But if you tax labor, there was no way that England could become the exporter that it became in the world. What he said then is the same applies today, and yet the neoliberals, who've urged just the opposite policy of the classical liberals, to untax land, untax property, and tax labor, claim Adam Smith as one of their forebears. And the whole thrust of 19th century classical economy was a reform program to bring prices of every country in line with the actual necessary costs of production, in other words, cost value, the labor necessary to produce goods and the labor in the capital goods, not what nature produced, not land rent or monopoly rent or financial rent that came from special privileges, such as the monopoly of credit creation. In today's world, what's different from the classical economist is that credit, it can be created on a keyboard for virtually nothing. And that's the credit that Japan and America are creating to lend to Australia. So Australia feels somehow as if it has to actually borrow this foreign currency in order to prevent the real estate bubble, and what it's doing is loading down its cost structure with an excess of price over and above what you really need to spend to produce goods and services to live on, and the economy is being more and more distorted by the FIRE sector, that is the finance, insurance, and real estate sector, which, although it's counted as part of gross domestic product in the national income accounts, the national income accountants separate it out because they realize that the fire sector is a kind of overhead. It's not really what's produced. The gross national product is really gross national cost. And much of the gross national or domestic product turns out to be the cost of doing business, not a necessary cost, but the overgrowth of the banking sector, the overgrowth of the real estate sector, the rising cost of obtaining houses, the rising cost of paying off bank loans. And this is not a technologically necessary cost of doing business. It's part of the financialization of economies. And as this financialization occurs, as economies are further and further indebted, companies, for instance, in America since the 1980s found that because interest is tax deductible, a corporate raider could borrow high interest junk bonds, 15%, buy a company that was paying, say, a 7% dividend, and take all the dividend, the money that was paid in dividends, buy out the shareholders, and you could pay out twice as much to bondholders. Now, paying out twice as much to bondholders meant that the government no longer received a tax inflow from dividend payments, from equity, because stock dividends are paid on an after-tax basis. So the government receipts of corporate cash flow have declined. The interest paid by corporations have gone way up. And what this means is that it's increased the cost of producing any given product that the corporation produces. Cars have a much larger proportion of interest rates, electronics, steel, right down the line. The economy is being burdened with more and more financial charges, rent charges, real estate charges, and the cost of paying labor, where labor has to pay higher and higher prices for rent. And the result is there's no way that American labor can really compete with foreign countries. Agriculture remains the mainstay of the U.S. balance of trade. That's what is primarily in surplus. For a long time, computer electronics was also, but a large part of California's computer electronics industry was by Indians. And the Indians, that is from India, not Native Americans, there's many of the Indians in California are now selling their houses because it's so expensive to live in California that they, for the price of a small apartment, they can get a whole palace with servants back in India. So there's an emigration of skilled labor from America for the first, really the first time in U.S. history. It's being balanced by an immigration from Russia of computer specialists into the post-Soviet economies. But if you look at the flows of immigration, you're seeing gradually a downgrading of the manufacturing sector, a shrinkage of the real economy, that is the economy of production and consumption, and a buildup of the financial economy so that people are making money off money, basically. They're making money off interest. And Adam Smith pointed out that no government in history ever has repaid its foreign debt. And the problem of his contemporaries calculated the rate of growth of compound interest. Any rate of interest can be looked at as a doubling time. And you can figure out how many years it takes for a savings deposit or a loan to double by the rule of 72. You divide 72 by the rate of interest, such as 5, and you find that that would be about 14 years. It goes up and down. And when you have a doubling time of that much, usually a 5% at 14 years, a little lower to borrow ends up about 18 years. This is what basically has determined the business, the financial cycle for the last century or so. Financial cycles are about 19 years, 18 years, as my colleague Fred Harrison has pointed out. And basically, the word cycle isn't a good term. Economies sort of have a ratchet effect, an exponential rise. They hit a limit, and then they go down very quickly. They a limit, go down. And basically, it's between 1 and 2. Between a given size, it doubles over the debt. Overhead doubles, then it falls back to norm. Doubles, fallbacks to norm. The question is, if you realize that a debt that can't be paid won't be, The next policy question is, how won't it be paid? In Iceland and Latvia, it's not being paid by a massive foreclosure process, a massive transfer of property from debtors to creditors. The alternative is what you have in the United States. In the past, the creditors would take the loss. The creditors would, if they make a bad loan people can't pay, they walk away from the house, the bank has taken a loss. In this case, over the last year, the Bush and Obama administration have created $13 trillion of new U.S. Treasury bonds, more than doubling, almost tripling the federal debt, and they've given them to the creditors to make the creditors whole. $5.2 trillion has taken the form of nationalizing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two government mortgage insurance agencies. Today in the United States, 90% of all new mortgages are federally guaranteed. That means it's not a market phenomenon anymore. That means that the government is determining the market by guaranteeing mortgages because the private sector people simply will not lend. Even so, the banks are not lending in America, and you have a curve that's very much like Australia's. You have debt suddenly going down, and when debt goes down, savings are suddenly jumping up. In Australia, the savings rate has jumped up. That doesn't mean that people are saving more out of their income. What that means is that they're unable to borrow more, and they're now having to use their income to amortize, to pay down the debts that they've run up, mainly mortgage debts. So the savings jump in Australia means money that has to be used for debt repayment. The negation of a negation is a positive, and that's what the saving is. But that form of saving is leaving less and less to be spent domestically on goods and services here. So the much of the domestic Australian economy is shrinking, while precisely because of the debt-financed property boom here. And in that sense, the property boom has not made Australia richer. It's made it more tied down by debt, higher cost, and less competitive in the international economy. That's my basic approach in the nutshell. And I move very fast, so I'd better leave time open for questions.
I'm got economics committee at the moment, so where people always look in the global economy and they say, well, is America going to remain the predominant driver? Is the effect of their debt now so immense that it's going to bring an end game to, you know, the process in America? And when you look at the Australian position, are we, because Australia sort of lauds itself as having a smaller debt, are we really just on the same path but at an earlier stage, or are we ahead?
The answer to the first question is yes. The era of U.S. balance of payments deficits and free lunch is over for the following reason. The United States Treasury owes $4 trillion to foreign central banks, $2 trillion to China, $1 trillion to Japan, and another trillion to elsewhere. There's no conceivable way, no scenario in which the United States can pay off one penny of this debt. The United States is running a chronic trade deficit because it's deindustrialized. They call that the post-industrial society, but what they mean, financializing the economy with a fire sector boom. So they're not exporting more. They are expanding their military bases, now 80 over the world. From during the 1960s, the entire balance of payments deficit was a result of foreign military spending. The private sector is exactly in balance, and the government actually makes money on foreign aid because it ties its aid to exports and gets dollars. Meanwhile, U.S. money managers are sending their dollar mutual funds and other deposits. They're spending them into euros. So the dollars are being poured into the rest of the world. The rest of the world has a problem. What are they going to do with dollars that don't have a chance of being repaid? And they're trying to get rid of them. Australia is trying to buy all the minerals that it can. In Africa, the Near East, and Rio Tinto, here, they're treating it like a hot potato.
China's trying to buy.
China. What did I say?
Australia.
Ah, I'm sorry. I'm in China's trying to buy. And other countries are also trying to do it. The Latin American countries 2 days ago announced they're trying to form their own currency. Last summer, there was a meeting in Ekaterinburg, Russia, where the BRIC nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, said they intend to make a new currency. China is beginning to issue yen bonds in its own currency so that it will be able to essentially establish its currency as international reserves. No government wants to get any further dollars. The question is, what are they going to do? They're letting the dollar go down, U.S. dollar. This is causing immense strains on Europe, not only because of U.S. Competitiveness, which isn't very much because they're not producing that much, but because of currencies tied to the dollar, Latin America and especially China. So we're in a period now where the whole international exchange rate system is fracturing. Australia will not be going down this route because Australian dollars are not held in other countries' reserves. Australia's more on a pay-as-you-go basis. It doesn't have a free lunch. The U.S. dollar had a free lunch because foreign central banks saved their savings in the form of loans to the U.S. Treasury. When foreign exporters would get their dollars, they'd turn the dollars over to their bank for local currency, which is what they operated in. The commercial banks would turn the dollars over to the central bank. And what did the central banks do? Central banks in the past haven't bought industry, they don't buy real estate, they don't buy stocks and bonds, they buy U.S. Treasury bills. And so the larger the U.S. government balance of payments deficit was, the more foreign central banks financed the domestic budget deficit in America by buying Treasury bills. 80% of America's budget deficit is financed by foreign central banks, not Americans. That's, Australia couldn't do that. When you run a budget deficit, your own people have to finance it, except to the extent that you raise interest and have a carry trade, in which case you're taking on a balance of payments outflow. And in fact, you're paying an enormous foreign currency premium what you're paying is not only the higher interest rate in Australian dollars by jacking up interest rates, you're creating a foreign currency obligation. You're pumping these Australian dollars into the hands of arbitrageurs that at the point where they begin withdrawing from these bonds, at the point where they wind down these trades, there's going to be all of these Australian dollars are going to be pushed back onto the market, pushing the Australian dollar down, and there's going to be a herd effect. Everybody who holds these bonds will see which way the foreign exchange is going. They'll dump the dollar. So it's possible that the Australian dollar could, say, rise up to $1.10 for the U.S. dollar and plunge to 80 or 90 cents. This is how, this kind of instability is how the foreign exchange markets work today, and it's made billions of dollars for currency speculators at the cost of domestic economies, because in a speculation, in a swap, one person's gain is another person's loss, and it's all a zero-sum game, and somebody has to lose to make all these billions of dollars for the speculators. So Australia's created a beautiful market for hedge funds and for speculators, riding the dollar up, selling it when it goes down, and putting your economy on a roller coaster that's going to make it very hard for your export industries and your importers to make stable planning over the few years.
So, with your, what extent of the GDP do you think, this is sort of a blank question, but to what extent do we have to deal with the fact that we get to a point where we can't actually repay debt? What is a sign, do you think, of an economy that can't repay debt? What are the warning signs you have to look out for that you say your debt is excessive as opposed to your debt is manageable?
The largest debt is, you have to break down the debt into different categories of debt. The largest form of debt in every economy, as I said, about 70%, is real estate debt. And that's basically debt against the land And since the land has no cost of production, about 3/4 of Australia's real estate debt is completely unnecessary. If it would have kept the original tax system you had maybe a half a century ago, I know more about, I don't know that much about recent Australian developments. I don't follow the Australian economy, but I did follow it in the 40 years ago when I was with Chase. Then you had a tax system that was keeping down your housing prices and making it being quite manageable because with the high property taxes, there wasn't any surplus to unleash into this huge property boom that came in the late 70s, in the late 80s and 90s. You're now at the danger point. As I said, 40% of income is certainly a danger point. 32% is. Another measure is if the housing price is 10 times the income of the home buyer, that's usually a limit. The equilibrium, economists for the last 300 years have defined the equilibrium price of property as the price at which the rental income will just exactly cover the mortgage. In other words, it's as cheap to buy a property as it is to rent a property. And you can buy a property for rent, and the rent is for paying interest. That's the motto of Donald Trump. It's the motto of real estate investors. The equilibrium point is where you can buy, you can look at a property, you're bidding against other people. The winning bid is, it used to be at the point where to buy an apartment house or an office building, the buyer would see the rent, he'd pledge it after tax, he'd pay the taxes, the maintenance costs, and everything left, he'd pay for interest. So the bank gets all of the rent. What the property developer wanted was the capital gain at the end. So he puts as little of his own money in as possible, borrows the money, uses the rent to pay the interest, and then just has it sit there. And if property prices are inflated, he cashes out and gets a capital gain. So the danger point is when this can't be done anymore, when it costs money. In other words, if you buy an apartment building, the rent won't cover the interest. Or if you buy a home and it actually would be cheaper to rent, you couldn't move out of your home and rent it out and have the rent cover the mortgage. If you sold your home, you'd have to pay the difference out of your own pocket. And in America, many people were willing to do that. They would buy property, they'd pay, they'd actually subsidize the renter by paying out of their own pocket. In 2005 in the United States, property prices were jumping, but rents actually went down. So many speculators bought property, apartment houses, rental apartments, that they thought, how am I going to pay the mortgage? I'm going to have to find somebody to rent it. And there was so many more properties absentee owned for rent that rents actually moved inversely to the house prices. That's instability. Prices rising above the income rate, that's instability. And for a corporation, it's at the point at which the corporate cash flow will no longer cover the taxes, the depreciation, the amortization, and the interest payment. And that when that happens, the corporations miss a dividend payment. And under the equity system, where if a company had remained issuing stocks instead of bonds, when your earnings go down, you can cut back dividends, and that's done all the time. But you can't cut back your interest payments. When you do that, you're insolvent, and the creditors take over, as you've seen with the car industry and the airlines industry recently. That's the instability, and it looks to me like Australia is moving towards that, both measures. For localities.
Yeah.
Yes.
Can you sort of tell us a bit more about what the background
of
that was?
The figures are all in Table 3.3 of the National Income and the statistics are all in Table 3.3 of the National Income and Product Accounts. And if you go into the NIPA, the Commerce Department from the Bureau of Economic Analysis has a table where they have the composition of state and local revenues. And essentially, here's the 70% mark, and here's the real property tax, it's gone down steadily to 16%. Meanwhile, the local income tax has picked up part of it, and the sales tax has picked up part of it, and the federal grants of aid have picked up another part, so that's essentially what the composition of state and local finances has shifted. Now the federal government is no longer giving the grants and aid to the cities, so you're having whole states such as California, Nevada, becoming essentially insolvent. They've been slashing services. In the United States, almost no state and local pension fund has been funded. So you have huge underfunded, no funding at all pensions that have to pay on a come-as-you-go basis. The financial community is now asking the government for government guarantees of state and local debt, realizing that California is probably going under, other places are going under. The only thing that states and localities can do now is to raise the property tax back up. But if they raise the property tax now, the rental revenue has already been pledged to the banks of interest, so raising the property tax will lead to defaults on mortgages. Whatever way they move is going to make things worse. Economists call that an optimum position. An optimum position is anything you do makes things worse, so when you're painted into a corner, that's an optimum position, mathematically speaking, and that's what the United States is in. And you're in trouble when you're in an optimum position of that kind. So, did I answer the question about...
why has that shift happened?
Because the most... It's happened because voters have been fooled. The most unpopular tax in America is the property tax, and that's sort of amazing. In the 19th century, all of classical economics was based as a reform program. The progressive era, the social democrats, the labor parties, they all wanted to tax property, and everybody thought that that was fair because they thought of property rent as being unearned income. But today, it's unpopular because the real estate interests, and especially the banks behind them, have said, well, if we tax your property, then it's going to squeeze your budget and the cost of home ownership is going to go up. Whereas the reality is, if you tax the property, especially if you tax land, not buildings, but tax the land, that brings down home ownership, and the public does not realize what almost everybody did as a matter of course in the 19th century. There's been an inversion of perception, and people don't realize that the shifting the tax off property has raised their cost structure, not lowered it.
What do you say in places like New South Wales, for instance, where it's because of the taxes that are on the land itself? I mean, you're paying in some cases three times the price for the land is what you're paying to actually put a building on that block of land. And so we're not reaping the benefits out of the taxes that are on the GST and things like that that are on provision of materials and services to actually build the building.
My preference would be you only tax the land, not the building. Obviously, what Australia needs is building. I mean, it looks to me like you need more high-rise building, especially in Melbourne, where I was, where the whole city is so low and the result is urban sprawl. You need building. If you were to tax buildings, and if you were to tax the capital improvements, then you are going to add to the price. If you tax the buildings, you're going to leave less available, and you'll obviously the builder has to pay the tax. But if you tax the land itself, look at it as a windfall tax. In Melbourne, where I came from last week, they were talking about making a ring road and developing new infrastructure. When you develop a new road or a new subway system, property all along it goes up in value. You could easily make this. The question is, how is Melbourne going to afford this transport? You can easily afford it by having a windfall tax on the property around the road, because as soon as you make a road, the property values will increase. I'll give you an example from London. When they expanded the tube out to the Canary Wharf, the financial sector, the tube expansion cost about £8 billion. The increase in property values along the route was £11 billion. The City of London, and I tried to convince the mayor of this, and Mayor Livingstone wanted to, but there was opposition from the real estate interests. The City of London could have issued bonds to be repaid out of the windfall gains of property along the tube and self-finance the tube. That's what in the 19th century was called the rent of location, because he improved the location. And they didn't do it. They left the site value in the hands of the landlords as a free lunch while taxing the people to make the road. So they didn't tax the real beneficiaries, the economic beneficiaries of this road improvement. They could have, and by doing it, they would have kept down everybody's tax structure. But you're right, when I talk about the property tax, I would like to focus on land, not buildings. Yes. It all depends what governments spend on. Do you mean the stimulus package? My guess is that most of the stimulus package has been given to people who used it to pay their debts instead of defaulting. I mean, the first thing you pay out of your budget is usually the debt and taxes. The last thing you pay is money on yourself. So I don't know how much of the stimulus has been spent on goods and services and how much has been spent paying down their credit cards or paying the mortgages where otherwise they would have defaulted. There would have to be a statistical analysis, and I haven't seen any discussion of that. Yes.
You mentioned value capture to finance things like roads and railways. Is that done in the USA much?
No. As a matter of fact, that's how all the real estate fortunes are made, and there must be 50 Hollywood westerns and movies about everybody trying to buy the land where the railroad's coming through. And the railroads became the great beneficiaries by being given the land along their routes. So Thorstein Veblen wrote a wonderful book, Absentee Ownership, in 1923, saying if you want to understand an American city, and he was talking about small towns, but it could be New York City just as well, look at it all as a real estate promotion project. So in New York City, when they built a subway, the property went way up. When they tore down the elevated, property along Third Avenue went way up. So in America, the landlords have got the gains, and the economy as a whole has had to pay.
That's just because of the political culture where the landlords...
It's all a real estate promotion project.
Sorry?
It's all a real estate promotion project. That's the best way to look at the American economy, because it's all about real estate. Most families, the largest... element in almost every family's balance sheet is the home it owns. Two-thirds of Americans are homeowners, two-thirds in England, 90% of Icelanders, by the way. So they're all tied into the debt, and now they're facing debt peonage. That's the term that's coming back, that they're spending their life paying the negative equity to the banks and to the other lenders in Iceland, which are the pension funds, which are amazing. The pension funds are now impoverishing the very workforce that's been contributing to the pension funds. So there are a lot of, it's a mentality at work there that doesn't realize how self-destructive it is. Yes. Well, to answer the latter first about armed to the teeth, there's only one kind of war that a democracy can afford, and that's atomic war. A democracy cannot, Vietnam ended the idea that any democracy can mobilize, can have a large-scale draft. It would just wreck the balance of payments as it's done through England and France from the 16th, 17th century. No country can afford to go to a conventional war today, and America is not going to go to an atomic war. So I think you can rule out war as a solution. For the economy, I mentioned $13 trillion going to the banks in the financial sector, not a penny to the debtors. So the default rate is soaring in the United States. The adjustable rate mortgages are about to reset. Last week, the first statistics came out on the sale of foreclosed commercial property. The average commercial property that's being sold, the banks are only selling the very prime commercial properties in America, in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago that have held up. The banks are recovering only 53% of the loan outstanding on commercial property. The largest residential real estate development in the United States, Stuyvesant Town in New York, was bought out by this Tisch Sperling Spire real estate interest. That's now insolvent, and they're under their plan was to buy this large real estate environment, kick out half the people, and sell them as co-ops, and they were. It then turns out that's against the law, and they're now against the law, and they're now facing prosecution for the plan. And they said, "But we're the largest real estate company in America, and we'll go bankrupt if we can't break the law." So the judge is deciding: is he going to let them break the law and kick out 20,000 people from the apartment to break even, or is he going to make the law go? Well, 20,000 voters are a lot of people, so it looks like the largest real estate company is going to go under. The really big problem in America is the commercial real estate downturn. Nobody's foreseeing a recovery. I mean, not Moody's.com, not the professional real estate watchers. All of the forecasters are saying there's going to be that the 10 million American families are estimated to lose their homes this year and next. And when families are evicted, the homes are pretty, a truck usually comes up the next day, strips the house of copper wiring and of other goods. The houses are stripped, destroying the value totally. Mayor Boyko of Cleveland has proposed bringing public nuisance claims against banks for foreclosing and leaving houses vacant, or they become drug dens. So the cities are facing default as a result. Now that the foreclosures are taking place, the tax revenues of cities are shrinking. They're laying off labor. The unemployment rate is now officially 9.8%, and it's expected to soar up to about 12% by this winter. This is economic shrinkage, and when something shrinks, it's not a smooth, we're not in the realm of marginal economics anymore. We're in the realm of structural change, and there's a structural change coming. Obama is very much like Putin in Russia in the sense that he's doing nothing. In Russia, that was a good thing. Putin stopped the Yeltsin giveaway, but doing nothing made him the most popular guy in Russia. Doing nothing for Obama has not made him popular. His popularity is polls are sinking faster than George Bush's in his administration, and people are just realized that the guy who promised change has done less change than any president, you know, that they can remember since maybe Buchanan in 1856 before the Civil War. Nobody's changing anything, and he's just standing there. He's turned over economic management to the same people who pushed the economy down under Clinton, except for the Bush appointees he's kept on. So there's political instability. Nobody knows what's going to happen. The unemployment rate is over 20% in Detroit. The whole city, whole block, square blocks are emptied out. When I moved to New York, there were in the 60s, pretty soon there were whole square blocks emptied out. In the 70s in Chicago, the area I grew up, Hyde Park, near the University of Chicago, block after block burned down. This was normal in the 70s, and people are saying some cities are going to look like that again, like Las Vegas. At the point where people unwind the loans. In other words, once Australia raises its interest rates, it's attracting money. But what's going to happen when it stops raising them? When it stops raising the interest rates and when it lowers them to try to spur recovery and every economy turns down, then all of these speculators who have borrowed foreign exchange to buy Australian high-yielding bonds are going to sell these bonds and convert the money. When they sell them, they'll convert their money from Australian dollars that they get for selling them back into yen or U.S. dollars or euros, and all of a sudden that will pull the rug out from under the Australian dollar, and the run-up will be reversed and it'll fall back down. Nobody knows. Nobody has a clue.
Who's in a better state? Is it Europe?
Nobody. No. Here's a problem with Europe. A lot of people would like to buy euros, but the European Union has a rule. It's being broken now, but the rule is you can't run a budget deficit of more than 3% of GDP. That means that you cannot use Keynesian policies to pull yourself out of recession. Now, almost all the European governments, so right now it's 12% in Latvia, Germany, France, they're all increasing the deficit. But the fact is that there are not enough euro bonds to buy euro because they haven't run a deficit. In order for people to speculate in a currency like China's currency, the government has to have run a deficit and issued bonds, but it hasn't. Latin America's debt's in dollars, not in its own currency. So that earlier this week, Venezuela, Brazil, Bolivia, they're going to begin issuing debts in a common currency, and this usually leads to a political unification. They're just beginning to provide an alternative to the dollar, but no alternative exists. So when there's no currency to move into, there's no way you can protect yourself, what are countries going to do? The answer is they're going to stop getting dollars. They're going to say, why should we export our goods and services? Why should we sell our companies for dollars that all we get is something useless? And they're trying not to run a budget deficit, a balance of payments surplus. This is what Malaysia decided. They have enough for foreign reserves. And I met with a former Prime Minister Tun Mahathir earlier this year. And he said, look, if we have foreign reserves, it's like having an oil well. Somebody's going to come and want to rob us. And we're going to avoid having reserves and keeping them down because we don't have anything to invest our reserves in. There's no currency around. There's no safe haven. The whole world is shrinking, and all the most sophisticated money managers I know have their money the same place I do, short-term money market and treasury funds. There's nothing better. We're not risk takers. Yes.
I do possibly see one alternative to currencies, and that is to go back to a commodity-based monetary system. What chances do you see of perhaps returning maybe to a gold or a silver standard? Because as I see your thesis, if the US tries to maintain its fiat currency system as it stands, it faces massive deleveraging and deflation.
The answer is zero.
If they decide to default on their obligations and essentially dump the dollar, they face a hyperinflationary scenario.
The answer is zero chance. There's not enough gold to go around. And to go on the gold standard, you'd have to have a price of $10,000, $20,000 an ounce. I'm sure what you really mean is the gold exchange standard, which is used to settle balance of payments deficits. The U.S. would fight against that because it was the Vietnam War that drove America off gold in the first place. No country on a gold standard can afford to go to war. And the United States wants to keep that option open, so you can be pretty sure that it's going to oppose that. The central banks are not accumulating gold. I thought that it might be interesting if a few other banks suddenly, who bought up all the gold futures and went to it, but that's more just a game to play mentally. It's not a reality in international financial circles. Individuals can buy gold. Small gold, gold is a small portable object, and it's very good for bribing border guards, but you don't have to bribe border guards anymore. And countries are just not willing to put a straitjacket on again.
Although I feel that the U.S. may be forced into that choice, especially.
I can guarantee you, I've worked with the U.S. government for many years, and there's no. In 1974, Herman Kahn and I made a presentation to the Treasury down at the White House President Ford, no, he was vice president at that time. He was there, and I wanted to call it gold, the peaceful metal, because if you had gold, exchange standard, you wouldn't be able to fight the war. Herman put a chart up on the wall of the world, a map of the world, and he had the map of countries that believed in gold, and that was almost the entire world, and the countries that didn't believe in gold, that believed in paper currency, and that was Western Europe, Canada, and the U.S., Australia, the Protestant, he called it the manic Protestant culture area. And these are people who trust the government. The rest of the world who invested in gold are people who didn't trust the government. The third world, Asia, India. So it's interesting to look at that, but the Protestant white manic atheist culture area is convinced that it's the government can solve the problem and they're not going to go back to gold.
So then what are the prospects then for the loss of trust in fiat currencies, particularly the US dollar?
I don't think anybody trusts the dollar. I use the dollar not because I trust it, but because I have to spend it and there's no alternative, as Margaret Thatcher used to say. And I think all over the world, that's the problem. There's not enough of any vehicle to hold your savings in except the dollar, which basically is the congealed American military spending abroad. So that's the irony. That's why China and Russia at the Yekaterinburg said, why on earth should we continue holding dollars when by holding dollars we're making loans that essentially are turned over to the Pentagon to surround us with military bases to prevent us from moving out of the dollar? Now, the only country that covered, this was a quantum change in the world structure. The only newspaper that covered this was the Financial Times in the column that I wrote for it. It wasn't discussed in any American paper. Similarly, Iceland and Latvia. The only discussions of them are my columns in the Financial Times. And the explanation is cognitive dissonance. People can't imagine an alternative to the dollar. They can't imagine that countries are so debt-ridden that the economies are collapsing and people are having to emigrate and that they're not getting rich from the housing bubble, but they're getting deeper in debt and being forced to leave the country to avoid a life of debt peonage. Cognitive dissonance. They can't understand it. And so you're just not reading about this in the paper. That's the amazing thing.
But you don't believe that an alternative will be forced on the U.S.? I'm not necessarily saying that.
U.S. Treasury Secretary John Connolly said, the dollar deficit is your problem. That's what friends are for.
Can I just throw a curveball at you on that one? What about carbon trading? What about fresh air and trading on fresh air? It seems to be something that the Americans and the
westernized
economies are very, very keen.
There was that movie with the Terminator guy where it was all about monopolizing the fresh air. If you'd have currency in fresh air, can you imagine Wall Street and the City of London, only all the fresh air in the world, and you'd all asphyxiate to death very quickly?
This is no movie. It's happened as we speak.
I know. Matt Taibbi, the best article on that was written by Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stone last month on how carbon trading is making a bonanza for Wall Street without affecting the actual carbon use and pollution at all. So all this is, the carbon is instead of having a carbon tax, the carbon trading is simply creating hundreds of billions of profits for Wall Street trading companies.
So it's
a disaster.
It's
a disaster. Yeah. If there were, I probably would have moved there. Everybody would like a country like that. I mean, I'm trying.
Is there one that's sort of doing it better than any other one?
It'll probably be the countries that are restructuring are the most seriously affected ones. And the reason that I'm spending my time in Iceland and Latvia is they're already in, essentially their real estate's already bankrupt. They're already sticking the banks. They're going to essentially annul their debts in practice. It's easy to do when all the banks are Swedish banks. And when the Prime Minister last week picked up my statement that debtors are not personally liable for real estate debt, Sweden said, this goes against all tradition. And the Latvians said, what tradition are you talking about? Feudalism? When we threw you off in the 15th century? You think you can conquer us financially with what you did militarily in the 15th century? You know, no. And they said no, and they're willing to make a change. So basically, the post-Soviet economies said, we've been tricked by the neoliberals, and we've been tricked by Europe. We thought Europe was going to make us like them. We thought Europe was going to help us become social democracies like them. Instead, it looked at us as a colony for its banks and a colony for its exports. The EU told Latvia to cut down its largest industry, manufacturing industry, textiles, because Europe had a surplus in textiles, and said, buy your textiles from us, disemploy your people. And that just pushed Latvia over the... They said, okay, we've been through that in feudalism. We're not going to go back to neo-feudalism. And so they're throwing down the gauntlet, and I'm hoping to make them the most reasonable country. And I'm going from here to China, where I'm supposed to work out a land tax policy with the government people. And I'm going to a number of universities with seminars and connected with some publications, my books on the topic. So obviously China's the big success story. But they so far have been a kind of Thatcherite communism, if that's not an oxymoron. And I'm trying to essentially bring back the classical economic approach of the 19th century of the distinction between productive and unproductive investment, productive and unproductive lending, and the distinction between price and value, which was eradicated in post-classical thought.
Well, we might take that as being the last question then. And you've given us a lot of food for thought.
That, thank you.
I'm not quite sure what to think about. Yeah, such a radical time we haven't seen before, and not an easy way out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like us all to thank Professor Hudson very much for his presentation. And we'll be putting all his future articles into Parle Info Search, you can bet on that. So thank you, everybody. Goodness me. What an extraordinary...
This is my card. I just want to say thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've got a lot of that. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Good to see you.
Who was the older man at the back?
He was
just giving us the questions.
He works for the economic.
Is he a good guy?
Yes, he's a very good guy.
He's not a big.
Very, very interesting.
Was Mr. Henry here?
No.
He wasn't, I think.
Very depressing.
It shouldn't be depressing for me. It's exciting. The whole world's going to change.
It's exciting for an economist, but it must be terribly depressing for people in Detroit.
Indeed. Yes, suicide rates are going up.
Yeah. Now, it seemed to me like deregulation, do you think perhaps is a form of regulation in favor of speculators?
The problem is... even with regulation, if you put a deregulator, an ideologue, in charge of the regulatory commission, then you've essentially deregulated. Deregulation has led to the disaster.
That's right. That's what I mean. It's almost regulation in favor of speculation.
Yes,
and
that's right.
Corruption.
Yeah.
And is there a case then for re-regulating currencies?
Who would do it? What do you mean by international exchange rates or what?
Yeah.
Essentially, that's dead now because the neoliberals are in control, and the neoliberals don't have a clue as to what's happening.